Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we speak with Celia Keenan-Bolger. She's up at American Repertory Theater doing Glass Menagerie. We also talk about Much Ado About Nothing, which is at Theater for a New Audience, and From White Plains, which is a new off-Broadway play. We talk about some news around Broadway and a little bit more, so please stay tuned. Until now,
most friends fade or they don't make the grade. New ones are quickly made, some of them worth something too. But us old friends, what's to discuss, old friends? Tell you something.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, February 17th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning, we have Laura Mata, Aileen McKenna, and Michael Portantier. Laura and Aileen are otherwise known as Lucky and the Mick from The Craptacular, that wonderful website that brings us Broadway news and gossip. They also write for Backstage.com. Good morning, Laura and Aileen.
Hello.
Good morning.
All righty. So identify yourselves. Which one's Laura?
I'm Laura.
And which one's Aileen?
I'm Aileen.
Okay, just for the listeners. And I get them confused, too. They're like peanut butter and jelly. So also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could also see his photography at FileSpotPhoto.com. He also writes for Talkin' Broadway, where I've seen a handful of new reviews. Michael, is that correct?
Yeah, actually, I just wrote my first actual theater review from White Plains, this really interesting play that maybe we can talk about for a bit later on.
Also with us this morning, we have a special guest, Celia Keenan-Bolger, who is up at ART, the American Repertory Theater up in Boston or Cambridge. Where is actually ART? Is it actually in Boston or Cambridge?
It is. It's Cambridge.
It is in Cambridge. That's
yes.
Right. Yeah, that's what I thought. And you here, Celia. Welcome. Good morning. How are you?
Thank you. I'm so glad to be talking to you guys.
Well, for those of us out here who are just too excited to remember, Celia, we've seen in Peter and the Star Catcher on Broadway. We also saw her in the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. She also did a stint in Les Miserables and a bunch of off-Broadway things. Of course, Peter and the Star Catcher before the transfer, Merrily We Roll Along, some City Center Encores things, some Playwrights Horizons things. But really, tell us about what's happening up at ART. You are in Tennessee Williams' The Glass Menagerie right now, and first of all, tell me how the Boston run is going.
It's amazing. it's been just a really wonderful experience so far. It's very cold here, which is why I sound like Kathleen Turner. but I've admired John Tiffany and Sherry Jones for so long. And to get to work with them has just been a real dream come true, truly. I saw Cherry in the Heiress so many years ago, and if you would have told me that I was going to get to be in a play with her, I don't think I would have ever believed it. So it's really been a wonderful, wonderful experience.
So John Tiffany is the director, we should point out.
Yes.
And Cherry is playing Amanda. You also have Zachary Quintero as Tom and Brian Smith as the gentleman caller.
Mm-hmm.
So you've spent some time up there in the last couple of weeks. Michael was just saying before we got on that he was going to head up to see you a couple of weeks ago, but there was a little bit of a snowstorm, wasn't there?
Oh, my gosh. It's more snow than I've ever seen in my adult life. we had to cancel three shows. It was that intense. But it also was, you know, it meant that we all like got together and went sledding on the Harvard library steps. So that wasn't such a bad thing.
Jonathan Groff told me he made it, I guess, just before the snowstorm
mm-hmm.
hit, and he just loved the show. He just thought it was amazing.
Oh, he was so generous afterwards, which was, it was so nice to have him there. That's the good thing about working in Boston is that it's not that hard to get there from New York.
Right.
So sledding on the library steps, a little girl from the Midwest of Detroit and University of Michigan, did you thumb your nose, you know, that the Harvard boys are...
It's basically like old hat. I was like, from being from Michigan, you're like, I know all about all of this. The cold, the snow doesn't really faze me.
I was just going to say lake effect snow that you get out there in Michigan and in Detroit, you know, certainly.
Right.
You just said that you've never seen so much snow. That's quite a compliment for you.
Well, she said in her adult life.
Oh, right.
Yes, yeah. I'm sure she saw a lot as a child.
Growing up, yeah.
Excellent. So, Lauren, Aileen, you had some questions for Celia. Why don't you ask her?
Yeah, so we were kind of wondering, you know, had you ever done Tennessee Williams before? How did you kind of approach this? Was it new for you, or did you kind of, had you had some experience with this before?
It was completely new and a little bit intimidating. I was trained in musical theater, and I can't say that the Glass Menagerie was something that was always on my radar as a play that I would want to be a part of. But as soon as we started, I feel like I read the play in high school, and then I read it again in college. And when I got the audition, just reading the play again, I felt like, oh my gosh, I've been missing out on this play. I'd never seen a production of it. And
wow,
it's so extraordinary. I said to my husband, when I was getting ready to audition, I was like, you know, the Glass Menagerie really holds up. And he was like, yeah. But it's been such a wonderful experience, sort of feeling the pressure of doing a play that is so beloved by a lot of people. And then almost within the first week, I felt sort of absolved of those feelings. And like, we were making a version of the play that we all wanted to make. And that's actually, I think, more rare than one would believe. but I've fallen in love with the play and with Tennessee Williams all over again in a really big way.
That's great. It's something that I was just kind of thinking of is that, you know, you were in Peter and the Starcatcher, which was a play that had these kind of musical-like elements to
uh-huh.
it. And I'm wondering kind of, is there anything similar with the Glass Menagerie? You know, you have John Tiffany as the director. You have Stephen Hoggett is doing the movement. You know, these
right.
are names that we kind of associate with musicals. So I was wondering kind of about that in terms of this show.
Yeah, I think that's also probably why I felt a little less intimidated, was because we were all from the musical world. And the music in this production is, in my opinion, one of the best parts of the whole thing. It's a composer called Nico Muhly, and there are entire musical sequences. In fact, in the first week of rehearsal, we staged all of the musical sequences before we sort of dug in to the scene work. And there's a really big physical element to this production, in sort of keeping with Tennessee Williams' plastic theater notions. So the music is hugely influential in this production. And I think lets the audience in. I mean, there's so much that Tennessee Williams doesn't say in this play. And I think in the musical interludes, you sort of get another emotional layer of what these characters are going through.
Wow, we can't wait to see it.
Yeah, we're all wondering when we might see it.
Yeah, you and me both. Or you could just come to Boston, come to the ART and before March 17th.
I'm coming. I'm set March 3rd, I think.
Good.
Yeah.
You know, ART has had such a... you know, they've always been a preeminent theater in the United States regional
mm-hmm.
theater scene, but certainly in the last couple of years has become somewhat of a Broadway player. have you seen this growth from the inside? What is it like? What are the things happening up there? That do you feel a special type of buzz up there that's happening?
I mean, I think it's the good thing about it is that you're just trying to make something good, like you always are. But I think they've obviously tapped into assembling groups of people that are of New York caliber. But then I think not having the pressure of building something in New York allows for a little bit of a different process. Mm. And in a good way, that brings out the best in the work, even though, you know, I was like doing laundry with Andrea Martin right before she left to bring Pippin to Broadway. It's attracting artists that want to make good art. But it's happening outside of the city. And, you know, like I think making the Glass Menagerie in Boston has been such a gift. And we talk about the show so much because we don't go home to our lives at the end of the day in the way that you do in New York. And so everything, the experience really becomes about the piece, about the play. And I think that is for the first time that we're doing it, that's a really wonderful element of it.
I assume you got to see Pippin.
I did. I saw it twice and would sometimes go in and watch Andrea Martin's number and then go out to dinner after that. I would just go in and see that.
Did you think about sneaking into her luggage and staying there and so she could take you to Broadway? Andrea,
I mean,
take me to the Broadway.
Seriously.
So tell us about your off-Broadway experience with Merrily. We were chatting before you got on the line about, we were wondering, was Mr. Sondheim there during the process? And what was it like to develop your character in Merrily?
I think he was around, and that was, Merrily was one of my favorite experiences of my whole life, I think. That show, since I was like 15 years old, has been one of my very favorites. And that role in particular has been a dream role of mine forever. So to actually get to do it with James Lapine and with Sondheim there, it all just sort of felt, and to do it in 12 days. I mean, it was a very rigorous, but also incredibly fulfilling process. And I think there is something about those encore shows that if you had more time, it would be a very different experience. And there would be parts of it that were much cleaner and parts of it that were much deeper. But I also think I felt like I really had to bring my best self because the amount of time was so short. But I also felt like I had been waiting to play that role for so long that I already knew a lot about what, just in my head and in my imagination, what I wanted to bring to the role. And then...
I was going to say, it's so funny to hear you say that it was your dream role. I know you had mentioned that in a talk back after one of the performances of Merrily, and the audience kind of chuckled at hearing that Mary was your dream role. And I think they're kind of, you know, they're chuckling because of the kind of difficulty of the character. You know, she doesn't have a very happy ending, or I guess a beginning, as it were. Her life seems so unresolved. And I was wondering kind of what specifically appeals to you about her.
I think that whole story of friendship is I feel like this is going to get so cheesy for one second, but my friends from high school and even more from college are the people that I am closest to still in my life. And I think the themes that get explored in that show are forever. And regardless of where you are in your life, there's so much that you can hold on to and what it means to sort of grow out of friendships and come back to each other and to be in love with somebody who is not in love with you. I mean, I think that we can all sort of attach ourselves to that story. I also think I always knew that she would be somebody, she felt like somebody who is very different from myself. Mm. And that part of it, I think, was also intriguing to me.
I got to interview Celia and her equally talented brother, Andrew, right before that show. And I seem to remember, maybe you want to tell the story, that you posted some photos online and you got in trouble.
Oh, yeah.
I
think they felt very protective of our process. And, of course, all of us were just so happy to be there we were posting photos and like, this is what happened at rehearsal today. And they were like, you guys, no more pictures, no more pictures and costumes. That's just the social media of the era.
Oh, I have a specific question, if you can answer it. I know that for the show itself, the final scene was reworked and sort of reconceived and rewritten a little bit. But then for the recording, they went back to the original version.
Right.
Was that a little tricky? Was there any?
It was. I think just because – I think it's I can't remember who licensed Merrily We Roll Along, but because there was – it hadn't been licensed in the version that we did at Encores. On the recording, they had to do
the
old version. But, you know, everything else that we put on that recording, basically, we had done. And so everybody was like, oh, okay. We got into the recording studio and had these new pages. And it was, if it felt like we were really spontaneous in our acting, it's because we just weren't that familiar with that last scene.
Right. Well, that's interesting.
So tell us about leaving Starcatcher to go do Tennessee Williams. it's quite a change, isn't it?
It is. I feel so lucky to get to play those two roles back to back just because they're so completely different. I feel like Molly was this powerhouse and Laura is the opposite. And doing a new piece and then doing, you know, one of the great American plays back to back, I just feel so lucky. Honestly. I do think I love new work and I want to do it forever and I want it to be most of what I do. But doing this play, I have had the experience where I feel like I almost don't have to do anything because the play is so good. And that whole gentleman caller scene.
Oh my God.
It's just one of the greatest things I've ever gotten to do in my life. I barely have to do anything because it's all there.
What I directed a production of the show once, and I think one of the things that always struck me about it is basically what happens in that scene, I mean, is so small, so unbelievably tiny in terms of the world at large. But for these people, it's like the saddest, most tragic thing that could possibly happen.
Right. And I think,
you know, it's just, it's so moving. It's incredible. And then it leads to basically destruction of the family with Tom leaving and mm-hmm. and his guilt over that, which he carries for the rest of his life.
Right. And the amount of time after that gentleman caller scene is actually till the end of the play. There's not that much that happens. That, you know, that scene ends and then the play pretty much ends. So
yeah, like 3 minutes later.
Yeah.
So tell us what's coming up for you after you wrap up in Cambridge.
I'm really excited to take a vacation, which I have not had in, I think, probably a good year and a half. I've been lucky enough to go from one project to the next literally without a day off. So I'm really excited to take a vacation with my husband.
You know, Broadway performers, whenever they schedule a vacation, that's when you're going to get crushed with the project that you can't turn down.
Right. That's how that goes. Well, I'm going to have to put something on hold because I just need a week.
Excellent. And your husband's also an actor, right?
He is. He's currently doing a play with Edie Falco at Manhattan Theater Club called The Madrid.
Excellent. So anything exciting for the vacation or are you just going to hang out?
I'm not sure what's going to happen there. We are sort of just waiting, I think, to see what else.
And you got
happens.
Both your schedules to coordinate to take a week off?
I think we will be able to. His show runs a little longer than mine, but then I hope we have a house in Los Angeles that we might get to just go be there for a minute. But I feel I think usually actors feel an anxiety not knowing what's coming next. And I sort of feel the opposite. I feel like I've just had an incredibly fulfilling couple of years, and I'm just excited to see, you know, what happens next.
That's great. Thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning.
Oh, please, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
It's so great. And Michael will come back and give us a stellar report, I'm sure.
Yes, well, you've already had Ben Brantley give you a stellar report.
Well, so. you'll be the judge of that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, you have a great day, Celia.
Great, thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, old friend, what do you say? Old friend, make it okay. Old friend, give the old friendship a break. Why so grim? We're going on forever. You, me, him, too many lives are at stake.
Laura and Aileen, you both got to go see a production of Much Ado About Nothing at the Duke on 42nd Street. So why don't you tell us about that?
So this production is being done by Theater for a New Audience, and they're actually in the process of building a brand new space in Brooklyn. At the moment, they're at the Duke on 42nd Street, and we actually really like this production. It's not like a crazy out of the box Much Ado. It is set in kind of turn of the century Italy. The costumes are very beautiful. If you are sort of into lovely period costumes, which we of course are, but we really liked it. We thought the performances were really great. Jonathan Cake is a very, very handsome Benedict. I confess that it's my favorite Shakespeare, so I'm slightly biased. To me, those characters are pretty irresistible, and it's a comedy, and it's light, and we thought this was really lovely. It really did kind of justice to the sort of lovely elements of the play.
Yeah, it was, I liked it. It was set sort of like, if you've ever been to the Duke, you can set things in all kinds of directions, and this was sort of like a partial round. It was like semicircle a little bit, I really liked the way that they used the space. I loved the performances. Maggie Siff was Beatrice and Jonathan Cake was Benedict, and they had great chemistry, but they were also equally very strong on their own. And Jonathan Cake's really nice to look at. So he's a little like if you punched Patrick McDermott in the face a couple times, like Patrick McDempsey, sorry, like he was so beautiful and so good. Like he really inhabited the role. It was a fun time. We saw it on Valentine's Day. So we had a little girls' date on Valentine's Day, and it was kind of the perfect thing to see that day.
And I think the thing with that show is that you have to have a Beatrice and a Benedict who really, really can kind of, you know, who need to be really well matched. They need to be as strong as each other. And these two really are. And that's kind of one of the happy things about this production. So we really liked it.
That's great. So it is playing at the Duke, as you mentioned. I think that it's opening night tonight, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
It is.
Excellent. And it's, I think it's playing for about a month or so. I had it right in front of me, but now it's gone. So everybody, I will put a link to it in the show notes if you want to check it out, if you are listening. And see what's happening there. So, Michael, you mentioned that you were reviewed for Talking Broadway.
Yeah.
From White Plains. I don't know anything about this, so fill me in.
Well, it's a very well-written play about a very timely, unfortunately, tragically timely subject, gay bullying. It's to make a long story short, it opens up with these two friends sitting on a couch and they're watching TV, and you can see on their faces that, you know, something quite shocking has just happened. And it turns out that what they've seen is they've been watching the Oscars, and this fellow has won an Academy Award for writing a film about based on a true story of this fellow who was bullied mercilessly in high school for being perceived as gay and who subsequently killed himself. And it turns out that all of these people, the two friends watching and the boy who was bullied and the fellow who's winning the award all went to the same high school, and that the writer who's winning the award names one of these two guys who are watching watching the awards as the bully. Although at first he doesn't even remember the situation that much, or he remembers the kid he bullied, but he doesn't even remember the other one who's winning the award. So then it's all about the fallout from that, this you know, quote unquote bully, is his friendship with his best friend starts to deteriorate, and his relationship with his girlfriend starts to go south, and everything just kind of begins to get messed up for him in his life. And the guy who won the award for writing the movie is implacable and relentless in going after this guy and not accepting an apology, and really, really not being able to forgive him. And it all culminates in a scene. We don't actually see the event, but the bully and the guy who won the award are preparing to go on television to kind of confront each other about this situation. And it's just, it's so well written because it seems so realistic to me. It's not manipulative. It's not cliche. It's not terribly obvious either. I think when you're writing about something like this, you have there can be a tendency to just kind of be a little obvious, and that doesn't happen here. There's a lot of subtext, which I think is wonderful, and the emotional transitions of the characters and the actors are really excellent. What's interesting about the play is it's billed as being written by Michael Perlman with Craig Wesley DeVino, Carl Gregory, Jimmy King, and Aaron Rossini. And those last four people are the four people who make up the cast. So you don't usually see that kind of a credit. But to me, I guess it's a good thing in that acknowledging that the actors had a lot of input into the actual script. So that is, you know, that struck me as really interesting, and especially that it turned out so well if it was – you know, written by committee, if that's the word you want to use for it. So I would really highly, highly recommend this play. It's a Fault Line Theater production, but it's being done in the studio space at the newish Signature Theater Center on 42nd Street. And it's really very well written and very well acted. I think a play about a subject like this bears an extra responsibility to be really good. I saw a play not too long ago that I won't name that actually claimed that it was about gay bullying, and it seemed to like an attempt to sort of quote, you know, sort of capitalize on that, if I can use that word. And it was, first of all, not well written at all, and secondly, it seemed to me that this other play I'm talking about was not really even about gay bullying. That was just a very, very tiny part of it, and it almost seemed like they grafted it on. So that left a very, very bad taste in my mouth. But From White Plains is highly commendable, and I definitely recommend everyone try to go see it. It's not a very long run, as one might imagine. I think it's through early March, but check it out and do try to get there if you can.
All right, so that's From White Plains. I guess we will put a link to that in the show notes for those of you who want to take a look at that. You can see those show notes at BroadwayRadio.com, of course. We had some sad news that happened this week. Kevin Gray unexpectedly passed away of a heart attack. Kevin was a Broadway performer who appeared in Phantom of the Opera. He also did a long stint in Miss Saigon on the road. And he was teaching at the Hart School in Hartford, training the next wave of performers to come and support the arts.
Well, the first time I saw Kevin was in a very well-received off-Broadway revival of Pacific Overtures. It was 1984 at the Promenade, and it was directed by Franz Soder with choreography by Janet Watson, and it had Kevin and Ernest DeBuba and a really wonderful cast. I remember that production was very, very well received, and he was quite excellent in it. And also, I guess not long after that, I used to sing in the New York City Gay Men's Chorus, and we did a Bernstein concert that actually Comden and Green hosted, which was amazing. And I knew Kevin's agent, and I got him to come and sing several things in the concert for us, including we did an all-star quintet, West Side Story quintet. I mean, if Sondheim tells us it shouldn't be called a quintet, the Tonight Ensemble, and Kevin played Tony, and Rebecca Luker played Maria, and Debbie Gravitt played Anita, and Kurt Ullman, the great baritone, played Riff, and of course we, you know, the chorus were the Jets and the Sharks. So I'll never forget that. That was kind of amazing. My friend, the agent who used to represent Kevin, Alan Willig, said, I spoke to him this week and he was so upset. And he said, Kevin never missed a workout and he never gained a pound. So I don't know what, I mean, this does not mean that we all should not work out, but it just shows that, you know, no matter how well you, how
can happen hard, to anybody. Yeah.
Yeah. No matter how hard you try to keep yourself in shape, it, you know, the things do happen sometimes. I guess he had a massive heart attack. So it's a great loss. And yes, he had been, I guess he had been mostly teaching in recent years rather than performing, passing on his, you know, his expertise and talents to new generations. So, very sorry to see him go.
Laura and Aileen, one of you had mentioned that you had seen him in the first show you've ever seen?
Yeah, I was. Kevin Gray played the Phantom in the first national tour of the Phantom of the Opera, which is the first show I ever saw. I was 12 years old, and it was like basically the event that kind of made me a theater fan. So I was so sad to hear this week. And I think at the time, he had been one of the youngest actors to ever play the Phantom at the time. I want to say he was just in his early 30s. And, you know, this is not long after the show had opened. There hadn't been very many actors to play the Phantom besides Michael Crawford. So Kevin Gray was very young by comparison. And I just remember that performance so well, even though it was at the Wang Theater in Boston, which has about 4,000 seats and is a barn. And I think we were in the third to last row, which means that the people on the stage are ants, basically. And I still have such a strong memory of that performance because Kevin Gray, when he sang, had this kind of, he could do eerie very, very well. And that was something that I still remember it to this day. And I also saw him in Miss Saigon, actually. He had done Miss Saigon. He actually is captured on one of the major recordings of Miss Saigon, actually. They did a kind of symphonic recording of Miss Saigon that he is on as the engineer, but he played it on the road for many years. But he also did it at the North Shore Music Theater, which is where I saw him as the engineer in Saigon. And that was a role that just seemed like, you know, it was sort of made for him. He had this kind of, he played the engineer with this kind of frenetic quality that worked so well. And he was this kind of thin, kind of tall actor. And he was perfect. So I was so sad to hear of that this week. This is an actor who was such a part of kind of my formative years of, you know, a young theater fan, and loved him so much. So I was sad to hear that news this week.
He had an amazing, almost opera quality voice, tenor voice, and it was always a shock to me to hear it come out of this fellow who, as you say, was really kind of slightly built, you know. And then there was this amazing sound that came out. Boy, that's amazing! I didn't know that that Phantom played at what used to be called the Wang Center.
Yes.
Yeah, in Boston.
I mean, that's not meant for shows like that. That's crazy.
No.
Well, the Wang Center was, it's this huge, what was it called before the Wang Center?
I think it was called just the Music Hall, I think.
Music Hall or something. But it was the Wang Corporation gave them a ton of money, and right. they named it. It's a beautiful theater in
and
Boston.
And what's the current name?
I think it's called the Wang Theater now, I believe it's called.
Oh, I thought Wang was removed from it, but I really don't know.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that's what it's called now.
So, yeah, it's I actually saw Kevin and at the Wang a few times. So, it's...
Oh. One more thing I have to mention is that actually when I saw The Phantom, there was an understudy on as Christine that night, and it actually was the woman who would become his wife. Dodie Petit uh-huh. is her name. And
oh,
was,
wow.
Yeah, and she wasn't even regularly in the role. She was an understudy, and I did see her that night. So that's another thing that I will always remember.
Okay, I looked it up. Apparently, it's still the Wang Theater, but... the global name is the City Performing Arts Center.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Oh, good to know.
That's the collection of theaters, isn't it?
Yes, the Colonial and the yes. Schubert. Yes.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Wang.
Yep.
That's right. That's a beautiful area of town to see a lot of great theater up in Boston.
Indeed.
So, other things in the news are that... the Public Theater has announced the summer schedule for Shakespeare in the Park, and we have Love's Labor's Lost and Comedy of Errors coming in. So, Aileen and Laura, I think that you want to say something about Love's Labor's Lost.
You can't see me right now because this is radio, but I just made like a big scream face. I want to scream. I'm so excited about Love's Labor's Lost in particular, because it's Michael Friedman and Alex Timbers, who were the composing and writing team behind Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson. And Alex Timbers also worked with Roger Rees directing Peter and the Starcatcher. And I'm so in love with him that it's hard to breathe right now. And I cannot wait to see what they come up with for this. We've heard some good things about workshops, and I'm dying. I can't wait. I literally, when they made the announcement, I was looking at Twitter while on a conference call for my day job, and I cried. I was so happy. So I can't wait.
Well, I'm not sure, but I think this may be the first time. I mean, the public doesn't usually do musical versions of Shakespeare in the Park, but they did at least one very notable one, Two Gentlemen of Verona, but that was in 1971. So I think this may be the first time since then that they've actually done a full-out musical based on a Shakespeare play as part of their season in the park. So it's very, very newsworthy for that, you know, for that reason. I'm sorry. It's very, very newsworthy for that reason, yeah. Aside from everything else.
And it's interesting to see their relationship, Alex and Michael, because they started, you know, did a lot of work on Bloody Bloody at the Public. So it's interesting to see that relationship continue and grow. And I'm literally crying with excitement.
And I wonder too if it will be a kind of, you know, their kind of take on stuff tends to be very kind of hip and modern and young. And it'll be interesting to see if they kind of bring that to the piece, because I think that would be really fun to kind of see what the language is that they're going to use and what their kind of choices are, because they always kind of come up with something that's kind of, like I said, kind of edgy and like a little bit zany. So I want to see what happens with that.
Yeah. And it'll just be interesting to see how something like that, if they really bring the sort of Timbers Friedman charm that we have already seen to this, it'll be interesting to see how that plays in the park with this kind of an audience. And the thing that I loved about getting Bloody Bloody to Broadway was that it made me feel like, look, anything can be on Broadway. Anybody can be exposed to any kind of theater and learn and take from that some, you know, even if it's like, I learned that I don't like this. And so I'm interested to see how this works with this audience in the park, because I think anything can be in the park. Anything can be on Broadway. And I'm excited to see how this plays and how they develop this.
And as for the other show, the Comedy of Errors, what's interesting there is that play by Shakespeare is very famous as a musical, the boys from Syracuse, Rogers and Hart. But they're not doing that. They're doing the original Shakespeare and Jesse Tyler Ferguson, who's become very well known and beloved for his work on TV on Modern Family, is in it. And Hamish Linklater, who also has a lot of TV credits in addition to his stage credits. So I think that's going to be a delight also. That those are the only two people who've been announced for the cast of that show. So we have to see what else they have in store for us.
Hamish Linklater is 6'4". And
yeah.
Jesse Tyler Ferguson is, you know, I would say in the 5'8 range or so, something like that. It's going to be interesting to, you know, the traditions of comedy, the two extremes. So
the first time I saw Hamish Linklater was as Romeo in Romeo and Juliet, which was, you know, really kind of amazing, especially if you look back, because he's not what you normally picture as Romeo. I mean, you know, he's got that comic sensibility and that kind of edginess, but he was very memorable. So I it was interesting to me to see the path that his career has taken since then.
All righty, so maybe in these shows that we're going to see this summer, they will be staffed by 10 of the hottest chorus boys and chorus girls that Adam Feldman from Time Out New York has deemed, as the girls pointed out before the show, none of the boys are wearing shirts. So Shakespeare in the Park, I mean, the summer might be good enough for them to do that. So what did we think of Adam's 20 hottest chorus people? Laura, Aileen?
See, it's a good looking list.
It is a good looking list, isn't it?
Yeah.
Cannot deny that.
Cannot deny that it's a good looking bunch of people. I mean, I think that there are some people on this list who are kind of like favorites of ours. There is an actor. Actually, he's not an actor. He's a circus performer who's going to be in Pippin. His name is
Orion Griffiths. And he looks like Ben Walker, if you bonked him on the head and he got like 4 inches shorter and like 10 inches more muscly and wider. And I stared at him through the entirety of Pippin. And then at a talkback after the show, I was like walking past as we were leaving and he smiled at me and I almost fell because he's so beautiful.
He's also British, which hurts nothing.
Yes. And like, and a circus performer, you should see where he can put his legs.
The picture of him in Time Out actually has him like contorted into this position that we sort of argued did not best show off his beauty, but it does show off how flexible he is.
His bendiness, which could be useful.
Yeah, exactly. Things. Exactly. So, you know, we're not complaining. I'm also looking right now at Ephraim Sykes, who also is very cute, and he was in Newsies. The other person who we were looking at before was John Arthur Green, who we had seen in West Side Story. He was wonderful in that show. And he's going to be in Matilda, actually, this film. We were kind of like, what is he going to do in Matilda? Like, I don't know. Matilda's a show that's like full of kids. So it's hard to imagine, like, besides the like Barty Carvel character, it's hard to even imagine what the adults even do in Matilda. But he's going to be in that. So, you know, we'll be not paying attention to the action and just watching him.
But also in Matilda is our friend Ryan Steele, who we had on the podcast a few weeks ago.
Unicorn of beautiful perfectness.
Yes, our favorite, our perennial favorite, Ryan Steele, who we love so much. So, oh yes, there is always lots of beautiful people for us to have crushes on Broadway. We're very excited about that this year, as we always are.
I think Broadway is like really good for that. Like we've gone to see a bunch of shows in the West End over the last couple of years. And like, I have to say that like, sorry, West End, but like our chorus boys and girls are like so much hotter.
So much cuter. It's so true. It's so true. Like
I've just seen like not that they're untalented, but just that they're like not, they're, maybe they have less to choose from. I don't know. But the chorus boys and girls over here are so much hotter.
Yeah, it's like, true. Oh. It's true. So.
And the thing about this production of Pippin is that it does include several circus performers, circus type performers, acrobats, tumblers, you know, every conceivable kind of circus performer. And as we might imagine, those people tend to be in even more spectacular shape than the average actor.
Well, I'm hoping that I see on the Craptacular in the next coming weeks rating system of bendiness.
I can't, you guys, like, oh, like, you'll, that picture of Orion is so bad, but he gets the second act opener. Like, he does a circus
act. Don't spoil it. Don't spoil it.
I'm not going to spoil what it is, but you'll, he gets the second act opener. And when you see him, like, you'll know who he is. You'll be like, oh, okay.
All right. So, bendiness. I'm thinking that maybe perhaps Bette Midler's new show, I'll Eat You Last, doesn't have enough bendiness in it because Mr. Riedel is saying that it's not selling very well at all.
No.
So, well, we'll have to see about that. I think that as before we started recording, we were talking about perhaps it was just a light week for news and that Mr. Riedel had nothing to write about. But well, perhaps he... I was thinking we were talking last week in a with Peter and Michael. I should say that Peter is traveling this week. I'm sorry, I didn't mention that earlier. He's with his lovely girlfriend Linda, traveling for her birthday. So he wasn't with us this morning. But when we were talking about a season preview last week, I'll Eat You Last. We were all looking forward to it, and I think it's going to be a hit with Bette Midler in it, but. They're not selling any tickets, so we'll see what's going to happen there.
Well, it's that they're not selling any tickets. You know.
Well, it's Mr. Riedel, so...
yeah, that's his interview. Yeah, his interview.
But I mean, I think also, too, if you compare it to, you know, Barry Manilow, where, you know, those tickets are... There's no tickets, and they're outrageously expensive. I mean, you know, I can see where, you know, you would think that maybe Bette would do the same kind of business because they, you know, have kind of... Like, they're sort of, you would think that they would appeal to the same audience, but I guess maybe they don't. I don't know. But I don't know. I want to go see Bette Midler.
And I think, like, I think the way that the advance works today is not the way that, like, a ticket advance worked 5 years ago.
True.
You just don't sell tickets the same way anymore.
Except in very rare cases, like the Book of Mormon, which if you don't buy a ticket now for, you know, 8 months from now, you're just not going to go see the
show. You're not going to go.
You know, that's about
pairing it against Al Pacino, which is a very different thing.
If you hold that up against Al Pacino and Glengarry, which is not only a famous actor, but it's also an extremely famous piece of material.
He's also not really a stage actor. Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of unique thing to see him on stage. But
and that cast was also loaded with other famous actors who other people like to see. It's so you're up against, like, I think a one woman show almost, right? With Bette and this.
Yes,
like,
it is a one woman
show. Yeah, it's a one woman show. It's just Bette. And to put those two things up, that's like apples and oranges. It's a difficult comparison to make.
And I feel like when Harry Connick Jr. did his Broadway show, I guess a couple of years ago, I feel like it was a kind of similar situation. Like, it's not like it was a crazy sellout. Like, I picked up a ticket, you know, like day of to see that show. So I feel like, you know, kind of similar to that.
And, you know, it's funny, we mentioned a few weeks ago, Peter had said that he was a little surprised that Bette Midler's show was going to be playing at the Booth. He thought it would be in a larger theater. But I said then, I think it's smart of them because they do realize it is a one-person show. It is about someone, Sue Mangers, the famous Hollywood agent, who is incredibly famous in Hollywood circles, but not known necessarily by name to the general public. Although if you start to list the people whom she represented, people would go, oh my God. So I think that, you know, that once there's more awareness of what this is and who it is she's playing and what kind of character it is, that I think this is going to be a very popular show. But I do think it was smart to put it in the Booth rather than a larger theater, because I think they'll set, you know, they probably will sell out every night eventually once we get there.
Michael, with some sort of creative marketing, they could talk about some of Sue Menger's clients and imply that they're in the show.
No, let's not get into that, because that was tried once before.
Yes, that's a story that Michael has told before. Yes.
But actually, I mean, one can only assume that some of those people are going to show up. I mean, the name that comes immediately into my head is Barbara Streisand. But there were lots and lots of very, very famous people whom she represented. So maybe they'll try to get them all there for the opening, wouldn't that? I assume that they will. And if they do that, that's going to be quite the event.
I saw something tangential to this. I saw a news piece this week that Bill Clinton is presenting Barbara Streisand with some award. What was it? I can't remember off the top of my head. Do you guys know?
I read it too. It's the Film Society.
Oh, yes, here it is. Chaplin Award, with ties back to Broadway. There it is. Bill Clinton to present Film Society Chaplin Award to Barbra Streisand. So,
silent film? Like, what is this?
The Film Society at Lincoln Center, April 22nd, blah, blah, blah.
It's just named after Chaplin. It's for a body of work.
Okay.
Yeah.
There it is. You might remember back in the days of Mr. Clinton being in the White House, being the president, that Barbra Streisand was a big supporter of the Clintons and raised a lot of money.
Yes, yes, yes.
A lot of that Hollywood money that the right wing is upset about. So, okay, I guess that wraps it up for this week. Upcoming, we have three things to talk about that is going to be, you should put on your radar screen. Michael, the Tennessee Williams songbook.
Yes, Celia was talking earlier about the importance of music in the Glass Menagerie. Music is very important in many of Williams' plays. And not only music, but sometimes actual songs have been featured in some of his most famous plays. So Alison Fraser is going to be performing a program called Only a Paper Moon, a Tennessee Williams songbook, which she did this past summer in Provincetown, and I had hoped to get to see it there, but I missed it. So I'm really glad she's going to be doing it here on Monday, February 25th at the Five Angels Theater. And it includes songs that, as I said, were actually featured in some of Williams' plays, including The Party's Over Now, If I Didn't Care, St. Louis Woman, and maybe the most famous one of all, It's Only a Paper Moon, which is very prominently featured in A Streetcar Named Desire. So I really think you all should put that on your radar because it sounds like it went over very, very well in Provincetown. And Alison Fraser is one of our most talented performers, actresses, and singers who maybe we don't see as often as we'd like to. So I would definitely put that on my radar. Also, we have coming up, this is interesting because this play, as far as I know, is really very rarely done. There's going to be a production of Look Homeward, Angel by Keddie Frings, based on the novel by Thomas Wolfe. And Austin Pendleton is going to direct the production at the Abingdon Theater Arts Complex, March 13th through the 24th. I actually saw the failed musical version of it called Angel way back in the day in, I think, 1979, sometime around there, with Fred Gwynn and Francis Sternhagen, and Don Scardino played the juvenile lead. That's how long ago this was. But I've never seen the play. So that is something that struck me as really, really newsworthy. I would definitely mark that in my calendar also. And then we have coming up, this sounds like it's going to be amazing, folks, at the end of this month, February 27th through March 2nd, the New York Philharmonic is doing Carousel at Avery Fisher. And apparently it's not really just a concert production. It's going to be quite substantially staged, and it even has credits for set design, Alan Moyer, lighting design, Ken Billington, costume design, David Woolard, and sound design, Peter Fitzgerald. So I'm very curious to see exactly how much of a full production it's going to be. But regardless of that, the cast is so amazing that I can't even breathe hardly. It's Kelly O'Hara as Julie Jordan, Nathan Gunn, the great opera singer who in the past several years has been doing more and more musical theater as Billy Bigelow, Stephanie Blythe, great opera star as Nettie Fowler, Shuler Hensley, who has been very much in the news lately with his performance in The Whale and also in Fiorello at Encores as Jigger Cragen, Jason Danieli as Enoch Snow, Jesse Mueller as Carrie Pipperidge, and Kate Burton as Mrs. Mullen, and John Cullum as the starkeeper, Dr. Selden. So if you like Carousel, this is something you don't want to miss.
you say Kelly O'Hara is going to be in this, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
I'm sure you hadn't heard about that.
No, who is this Kelly O'Hara? I don't know who she is. Why do you laugh?
Laura and Aileen, are you aware of Nathan Gunn? He's one of the quote-unquote Barry hunks.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was in Camelot. That Camelot that they did, actually it was a very, very poor production, but the Philharmonic did Camelot with Maren Mazzie and he and Nathan played Lancelot, and that was on TV. Did you see that?
No, but I feel like now we're going to have to do some investigating about it.
Oh, yeah. No, you should. And he also did Showboat at Carnegie Hall, I believe. And yeah, he's been doing more musical theater, and he's really... Yeah, he's really got it on every level. So you want to check him out.
We absolutely will. Thank you.
Nathan Gunn, G U N N.
Okay, I like his name. So
see if we can do some Guns N' Roses references to him.
We'll think.
All righty. So, and what's his bendiness factor? We'll have to get back. You let us know about his.
We'll get back to you.
Okay. All right, so let's wrap up. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded for you. Our contact information is there as well, so you can reach us, leave us a voicemail. Our phone number's there, our Twitter and Facebook. Also, contact information for Michael, Aileen, Laura, me, Peter, anybody else, plus links to some of the things that we've talked about today is at this page. So if you have any questions or comments, please go there and check it out. You can also listen to us as well as subscribing on iTunes on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If, in fact, you want to listen to us in another way, you can get us through the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your BlackBerry or your Android device, and listen to us streaming. So on behalf of Laura Mata, Aileen McKenna, and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Girls going to say bye?
Bye.
Get rich and saints get shot. It's called God Don't Answer Prayers a Lot. Okay, now you know. Okay, now you know. Now forget it. Don't fall apart at the seams. It's called letting go your illusions. And don't confuse them with dreams. If the going slow, don't regret it. And don't let's go too extreme. It's called what's your choice? It's called count to ten. It's called burn your bridges, start again. You should burn them every now and then, or you'll never grow. Because now you grow, that's the killer, is now you grow. You're right, nothing's fair, and it's all a plot. And tomorrow doesn't look too hot. Right, you better look at what you got. Over here, hello. Okay, now you know. Right?
So you'll find a new gang.
So you'll write a new play.
In a month or two, you're going to thank us.
You may have missed one road, but there's plenty more to follow.